I've never been expecting approval. It's nice if you get it, but you have to realize once you're past your first three or four albums, then no longer are you the bee's knees. You're no longer the latest thing, and you've got to accept that you're going to get your share of ho-hum or even very negative reviews. It's just the way things are. You know, if people are happy and they show their appreciation, then I'm delighted if that's the end result. But I don't expect it. It doesn't come with the territory just because you've sold a few million records.
Hello and welcome to episode 50 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now, this week's show features a fascinating interview with Jethro Tull legend Ian Anderson. But before we get to him, I just want to say that it's been some week for Vintage Rock Pod and for the world of classic rock too. We have to mention the sad news that Meat Loaf passed away on Thursday, aged 74. Now, I had just literally released a tribute episode on Monday, paying respects and looking back and remembering the legends that passed away in 2021. So for another legendary figure to leave us so soon after was a real shame, wasn't it? Now, when I heard the news of Meat Loaf's passing, I knew I had to do another special. He was that influential, and Bat Out of Hell remains one of the biggest selling albums of all time. I quickly listened back to previous interviews, I made phone calls, sent emails, and chats with people in the UK and America followed, and the special tribute to Meat Loaf episode was uploaded the same day. Now, it featured contributions from John Parr, who was given his big break by Meat Loaf and then went on to have a worldwide hit with St. Elmo's Fire, of course. There was Ellen Foley as well, who sang the female vocals on the Bat Out of Hell album, and national UK radio presenter on Absolute Classic Rock, Claire Sturgis, joined me too. And it's also a big thanks to Stephanie Myers, Mike Norris and Joseph Kay for their contributions on the show as well. Now, I just want to read some comments that were shared by listeners on the Facebook page, the Vintage Rock Pod Facebook page, and messages that had been sent by email. Mark Beavers said, "Bat out of hell and straight into heaven. Thank you, angelic man, for the love you've given. Poet, I met the man." Very lucky indeed, Mark. Denise Luscombe said, "Still too young to go." Can't argue there. A German media promoter said this, "Can't be true. Marvin is dead. Damn. Was allowed to accompany him so many times job-wise. He was a workaholic. His voice, his pure passion for music are unmistakable. I can't believe it. My dear, rock on there in rocker heaven. You'll find many dear musicians, companions. You'll never be forgotten." Lewis Doyle said he saw Meat Loaf 11 times in concert. Bat Out of Hell was such a seminal album for him. It blew him away. He says he'd never heard anything like it before. It's a sad day. Rest in peace, Marvin. And Troy Goff emailed as well saying, "Thank you for the tribute show. It was great to hear the stories of people meeting him. Meat Loaf had a bad reputation, but I loved hearing that everyone had positive experiences with him. There'll never be another Meat Loaf, that's for sure." Thank you very much for everyone getting in touch and messaging and commenting over the last couple of days. If you've not given that episode a listen yet, or the tribute to the stars we lost in 2021 with special contributions on that show as well, then please do go back and check them out. Please also check out the social media pages too. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, that sort of thing, you know the deal. And you'll find all the details on there, and you can join in with the community online as well. As for today's show then, well, it features an interview with Jethro Tull leader, the man behind the band for over 50 years, Ian Anderson. Jethro Tull's new album, The Zealot Gene, is officially released on Friday the 28th of January, so I managed to grab a quick interview with Ian just before Christmas to talk all about this new record. He dives into his songwriting process, which is a fascinating insight into the mind of a man who's been writing songs for, what, half a century? And not just any old songs as well, I mean songs on records that have sold over 60 million copies worldwide. That's the incredible footprint this band have left on the musical universe. Now, he's incredibly thorough in his working, and you're going to hear all about it soon, as well as news on the tours and concerts that'll hopefully be going ahead this year as well. Now, usually I get a bit of time with a guest to chat about the band's histories and talk about some of the big stories from the careers, that sort of thing, as you will know if you're a regular listener, but he was pressed for time, and I appreciated the space that he made for me, and to be honest, it's always a pleasure to get the chance to speak with someone of Ian's calibre. So, to provide a bit more Jethro Tull action, I also spoke with author Laura Shenton. She has a master's degree in music since 1900 from Liverpool Hope University, so she's really well placed to talk on the topic. She's written written so many books on so many bands, including Deep Purple, Dire Straits, Kate Bush, Supertramp, Tears for Fears, The Stranglers, ELP, and many, many more, including a number of books already on Jethro Tull, with another impressive one soon to be released. So to talk about that and her love of Jethro Tull, let's hear from author Laura Shenton. Welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, Laura.
Hello, it's nice to be here. Hello.
Hello indeed. Now, as I said, you've written a handful of books, haven't you, on Jethro Tull? So let's start with why. Why Jethro Tull? What is it about them that made you want to write so much about them?
I do hold a bias. I do think they're a fantastic band. I'm a massive fan. But I promise you that they're all objective in their narrative. So when I write about any band, the objective is always to recall what happened rather than talk the reader through my opinion. Because really, my opinion doesn't matter. I'm just one of millions of fans. I just happen to write about them. So it's really important to write something that doesn't say, oh yeah, it's a great band, you should think it's a great band too, because obviously by letting go of that bias, it allows me to provide something that's more substantiated. It's the afternoon, you can tell. It's a pleasure to write about Jethro Tull, because I think when you're writing about any band that you know, you really enjoy listening to, you're always going to find out more things because that's the nature of the research. And it's as fun to write as I hope it is for people to read about as well. And I don't think Jethro Tull have ever done a bad album. However, you're always going to have your favourites, as any fan would. And, you know, it's always nice to compare and contrast what different albums meant for the band in their career.
Absolutely. Now, to the non-Jethro Tull fans, they'll always be labelled as, I don't know, a folk band. I mean, my friend who likes classic rock, he isn't a fan of Tull, but he says, oh, it's that band where the guy stands on one leg and plays the flute. But there's much more to the band than just that, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I got into the band because when researching about Deep Purple ages ago, Ritchie Blackmore said that he was a big fan. He didn't tell me that. He's been saying it for decades. It's just that, you know, Blackmore is into the whole kind of like modal scales, and you know, that's very typical in folk music. And I thought, oh, this guy thinks they're great, I'll have a listen. And then I started listening to their albums and I was like, wow, amazing. And yeah, you're right, you know, it is a very folk sounding band in the sense of the scales they use, the instrumentation they use, but also Jethro Tull can sound quite heavy as well. So, you know, you've got Martin Barr's guitar solo in The Minstrel in the Gallery, the album's title track, and you know, the start of some of the songs on Heavy Horses are quite sort of metal sounding. I mean, I'm using the term metal extremely loosely because it divides opinion. I mean, some people say Deep Purple are metal, but others are like, oh no, you can't call it metal, it's more melodic than that. So it's interesting how certain genres have like certain connotations. So if somebody says folk, I think, you know, a person's initial impressions might be, oh, that's going to be a bit twee, you know, people sort of dressed up as elves and dancing around trees and stuff. But it's not like that. Melodically, there's a lot to be enjoyed, I think. It's the same with prog rock, isn't it? You know, a lot of people think, oh, that is going to be long-winded and self-indulgent. But, you know, some of it's really good. And indeed, Jethro Tull often get, you know, categorised under that umbrella.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Ritchie Blackmore there and Deep Purple and things like that, but they've also got an army of famous fans as well, the likes of Nick Cave and Rush and Iron Maiden too. They've all referenced, haven't they, Jethro Tull, and they're all big fans of what they do and what Ian does and everything like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's testament to how good Jethro Tull's output have been over the decades. I mean, there's always something you can learn from listening to their music. You know, even if you do so just for pleasure, you know, there's a lot of interesting ideas. I mean, the subject content of their albums was very different. I mean, while everybody, you know, how many people have written albums and songs about like love and relationships and all that kind of stuff? And during that time, you know, Jethro Tull have covered plays, horses, rural themes, you know, all the things that you wouldn't expect from rock music. And that's always a pleasure to listen to.
Absolutely. And you talk about the 50-year career now for the band and 11 gold albums, 5 platinum albums, sales in excess of 50, 60 million records as well. An absolutely incredible band and formidable in terms of the longevity. But if we go back maybe 10 years or so, when Ian decided to declare an end to Jethro Tull, and that was much to the anger and disappointment and probably other words as well, and certainly shock as well to Martin Barr, who you mentioned, who had been with him for 4 decades or so. Doesn't seem to be much chance of them getting back together, despite it being something that every kind of Tull fan would love to see happen, isn't it?
Yeah, and I find it really fascinating because in any other career, in any other field, can you imagine if somebody said, oh, you know, when you were in the office that day and you done that really great project with someone else you worked with, can you go and work with them again? And you'd be thinking, what are you on about? I can't work with them again. It's 10 years. It's been 10 years. And it fascinates me how with music, there's a lot of fans have this expectation that, you know, colleagues ultimately should get back together to work on something. And I think, oh, leave them alone. They don't want to do it. You know, I mean, it would be very nice for the fans to witness that. But I think if the individuals as professionals don't want to do that, I think fair play to them. I think I'd feel awful as a fan to think that people were doing something under kind of duress. That I don't think that would be nice for them.
And then in terms of the books then, I mean, you've written a few based on the albums themselves, but you've got a new one coming out very, very soon, haven't you? Jethro Tull Chronicles. We're talking from their early days through to kind of towards the end of the 70s. So tell us a little bit about what's going to be involved in this book.
So it's really meaty. It's actually, in terms of the word count, it's actually the longest one I've done. And the reason for that is that it covers a long time span. So from, you know, from them getting together in 1967 to like the fade out of 1979, so kind of just sort of post-Stormwatch really. And the reason the book's so expansive is because, you know, there were lots of lineup changes, but musically they always stayed on top really, not necessarily commercially, but in terms of, you know, I mean, they released an album for every year of the 70s. So really the book is a celebration and a document of everything they've done. So I've gone into lots of detail about, you know, what the feeling was in the band at the time. And I've used all vintage resources because I think it's very easy to look at these things with a revisionist lens and sort of think, oh, well, we all know blah blah blah, but you know, when you look back at the time, the band might have had different feelings about what they were working on. So for example, when A Passion Play was slated very badly by the music press at the time, it comes across that it was quite a surprise to Ian Anderson. I mean, they were under pressure because they had to follow up from Thick as a Brick, which was a huge success, but you know, all the same, I think the mood at the time is often very different to how people look at things with hindsight.
Absolutely. And you talk about going back to the time itself to get all the information for it. And it features vintage gig reviews and album reviews, as you mentioned. It's this contemporary quotes from the band members. There's rare adverts. There's countless photos as well, some of them unpublished. So you really have gone back and dug as deep as you can, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. Weimer, the publisher, they've been fantastic in sourcing never before printed photographs. So the book's going to be, you know, it's an unofficial thing, but it's going to be a real pleasure for any Jethro Tull fan to look at, really. It's got lots of new and interesting content.
And that's due out on the end of March, is that right?
It is, March the 20-something. It's the 20, I know, it's the 20-something.
Lovely. We'll put March the 20-something in our diaries. Laura, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you. It's been real nice to talk to you. Thank you.
And if you're a big fan of Jethro Tull, then you're going to want to check out this new book. To reiterate, it's called Jethro Tull Chronicles, 1967-79. Described as a mammoth A4 hardback book. Now, I preferred the hardback books. I don't know about you. It looks nicer in the bookshelf. This book chronicles Jethro Tull's career from the outset to the end of the 70s, featuring vintage gig and album reviews, contemporary quotes from band members, rare advertisements documenting how they were billed alongside their peers, and much more as well. Available at the end of March, we're going to say. I can't find the exact date, but as we heard Laura say, at the end of March, sort of some time-ish, 20-something-ish. So check out your bookshop online or go into the shop itself and purchase something in person. It's always lovely to do that. And so to the main man himself then on the programme, Ian Anderson. Born in Scotland, in Dunfermline, I believe. He moved to England when he was about 11 or 12. Music was always a passion, and legend has it he ditched his dream of being a guitar hero because he said he'd never be as good as Eric Clapton. So he went with a flute and hadn't actually been playing the flute all that long, just a matter of months before recording the very first Jethro Tull album, This Was. The switch to flute was inspired, and he remains arguably the best known flute rock player in the world, although he's not the only rock flautist we've had on the show. If that's your thing, please do go and check out the great interview I did on episode 20 with Thijs van Leer from Dutch band Focus. Fantastic musicians. Anyway, Jethro Tull, they became a real force in the world of music. At times, hard to pigeonhole. They are progressive rock, they are folk rock, they are progressive folk. There's blues and jazz infusions. They went a little bit electronica as well at one stage, and obviously huge helpings of thick heavy rock mixed in too. Now, Rolling Stone magazine described them as one of the most commercially successful and eccentric progressive rock bands. From their debut album in 1967 through to the end of the 70s, they did have huge commercial success with 5 top 10 albums in the UK, including Stand Up, which was a number one album. And in America, they had 2 number one albums, Passion Play and Thick as a Brick, with the utterly brilliant Aqualung not actually getting to the top spot, but going on to be certified 3 times platinum. Wow. They also won a Grammy Award too. Now, the much publicised and often used as a punchline to jokes after winning the Best Hard Rock Metal Grammy in a year when it looked nailed on that Metallica would win it. So much so that Ian has explained previously that Tull's management didn't even bother paying for them to attend the ceremony as they felt there was no chance they could possibly win. So, on to the Zealot Gene then. It's the brand new Jethro Tull album, which is set for release on Friday the 28th of January. It's the first studio album for a number of years, and it sparked a bit of friendly debate, which is a polite way of putting it, among the Jethro Tull fans online about the use of the band's name, given the lack of involvement of Martin Barr, the band's incredible guitar player from 1968 until 2014, when Ian decided at that point to call it a day on the band. Now, some say it should be an Ian Anderson album, but that can be debated amongst yourselves. Now, this interview took place a couple of days before Christmas, so his references to January the 1st aren't in error. This interview was conducted about a month ago, just to put it in a bit of context for you. Anyway, it is a fascinating interview, so here you go. Me in conversation with Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson. Okay then, Ian, let's start with the Zealot Gene. I mean, it's been a long time in the works, hasn't it? You began putting down the ideas for this originally in, what, 2016, 2017 or so?
Yeah, I mean, it was, in 2017, we did 5 days rehearsal and recorded 4 tracks. And then it all got put aside because we were on tour for quite a while. And, I completed those first 4 tracks. But then the rest of it, due to pressure of tours, only being home for maybe 2 or 3 days between tours, really, I just kept putting off going back in the studio again because of time constraints. And then suddenly the pandemic was on us, and it was not really possible for us to work together pre-vaccination and at times of lockdown. So it didn't get finished until this year, when I finally decided I would just have to get on and do the last 5 songs myself at home and get the album done, which it was, I guess, May, early June when I finally finished it and then mixed it and mastered it and delivered to one of the 6 record companies we've been talking to.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about the album itself then. I mean, you've released a couple of videos from it, from a few of the songs from the record. Now, what can we expect from the album as a whole in terms of musically and thematically then?
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Well, but in terms of the album itself, it began with the notion of writing a series of songs about extreme emotions. And I decided to start that off on day one of working on a new project. I wrote down a list, one word list of strong emotions. I you know, some nice things like compassion, loyalty, companionship, love, spiritual love, brotherly love, erotic love. I wrote down some nice things, and then I wrote down a bunch of the bad stuff, like hatred, anger, retribution, vengeance, jealousy, rage. You know, so I looked at my list of single words, and it occurred to me that I recall those featuring prominently in the Bible. And so I decided to do a big Bible search of examples of biblical texts that incorporated those one-word pointers. And then I copied and pasted a lot of biblical text, put it into a document, had it sitting on one side of my computer screen as a reference when it came to writing songs. I didn't use any biblical text in any of the songs. I simply took the essence of some of that and decided to try and put that into songs that were in the present day, in a real-world scenario, not in a historical biblical context. Although there was one song that probably does really sit in its original time and place. So that was the concept, if you like, was to create a variety of different songs about human emotion. And the title track, The Zealot Gene, was simply one of the songs. I decided, after thinking of a few album titles, to make it a title track. And it seemed to sum up perhaps some of the general fanaticism that goes with certain emotions. And I rather thought it would be a good example of emotion running high in terms of populism, division in society, and the subject material behind that song. It would be easy to say, oh, he's singing about Donald Trump. But in fact, there is no one model for that song. It's at least half a dozen people whose names come immediately to mind as populist national leaders who, whether they live in a pseudo-democracy or a virtual dictatorship, are people who I'm thinking of when I'm singing the words of that song. And as always, I tend to have something in my head when I'm writing a song. Usually it's a visual image. So I'm working from memories of photographic images, or in the case of the biblical references, when I read the biblical text, I immediately have a picture in my head. Then I take that picture and then write a piece of music about the picture. So I'm kind of writing about the, based on the, some of the elements of biblical text, but I'm once removed from it because I'm tending to take the text and then make my own little kind of movie or my own still image out of something I've read, and then write about that image in musical terms. Well, that's kind of the way I worked on this album, but usually I'm not starting off with text. I'm usually starting off with a visual image. Although there have been occasions when I can recall writing about something that I read as text in a newspaper before I saw any visual images associated with it. But, you know, that's my way. I'm an observational writer. I tend not to be writing about me and how I feel. You know, I'm not an emotional character. I'm a cold fish. And I tend to write about other stuff, not about my own emotions so much.
A fascinating insight. I love hearing them sort of stories. I mean, we're talking 50 plus years that you've been doing this, into the seventh decade, in fact, of producing music. I mean, do you still enjoy putting new music down and thinking of new things and ideas and themes for songs?
I hope so, because in just not much more than a week from now, I will be preparing to embark at 9 a.m., on the 1st of January 2022 on a new project, as I have done on the last four projects. I'm a 9 o'clock on the morning on the first day of a new year. That's when I think, right, I'm going to start. And so far, so good. You know, by 10 o'clock, I've got a couple of ideas, and hopefully by lunchtime, I'm, you know, kind of on the way towards something. And I hope this time is no different. Not met with a total absence of either energy or inspiration. But, you know, hopefully it'll come to me. And it's quite exciting putting yourself on the spot and making yourself go halfway to meeting the muse rather than waiting for her to visit you at a time convenient to her.
Fascinating. Now, in terms of The Zealot Gene, then, it's out on the 28th of January. There's many different formats it's available as well, isn't it? You've got your LPs, your CDs, there's Blu-rays, there's special edition books where there's demo ideas and initial ideas, and there's interviews and extra liner notes and everything like that, isn't there?
Well, the age in which we live is one defined really by options, whether you're going to a supermarket to buy a salad or a veggie meal or whatever it might be that you're after. You're going to have several options, and I think that's part of the musical world these days, is that we give people several different platforms in a way that they can listen to music, and of course physical product in the form of CDs, and for many people a return to the larger analog format of vinyl. So we're really giving people choice, and I think that's the important thing, that music fans have a choice. And some, of course, will say, "Well, I'm going to get the vinyl album, but I'm actually going to stream it on Spotify as well." So, you know, people will quite often not just go with a single way to listen to music, but they will combine a couple of other formats. And then in terms of complexity and price range, you know, we try and do the cheap and cheerful, the straightforward CD and a, you know, with a 16-page booklet or whatever it is, through to a sort of deluxe pack with surround sound and Blu-ray, whatever, and a much bigger package of books and you know, the original demos and a lot more information about the making of the album. You know, for those that want the you know, they want the full nerd version, you know, where they can really embed themselves in the trivia and yes, minutiae of detail that surround the making of the record. I mean, I was in two minds whether to include a lot of that stuff, and I discussed it with a couple of the record companies that we spoke to in detail, and, you know, they seem quite keen that I should put in, you know, pretty much everything that would be there to entertain at least some of the fans. But, you know, for most people, I think they're just going to listen to the music and not really want to get too far behind it in terms of either conceptually or in terms of any detail. They just want to listen to, you know, intro, verse, chorus, bridge, guitar solo, flute solo, whatever. And maybe they don't even really listen to the words. They just hear it. But I think it's nice to be able to make sure that people have the text of the lyrics to refer to, because some of it, you know, I try to make my diction reasonably good, and but nonetheless, you know, some people, particularly those who don't have English as their native language, you know, might benefit from having the lyrics printed, preferably in a font size that suits older eyesight. So we do it really you know, try and provide a version of the album that will satisfy most people's preferences.
Definitely. And the best way to find out all these details and how you can pre-order is to get onto jethrotull.com, and you can keep up to date with everything that Ian's up to and everything the band's doing. And certainly something the band is going to be doing is a big tour across Europe, COVID permitting, in 2022. I think I counted 11 different countries. It's on the back of quite a few dates you did in the UK at the end of 2021 as well. So are you still enjoying going out there and playing the music, and you're looking forward to seeing the fans across Europe?
Well, yes, I mean, there are actually quite a lot more shows that are projected for 2022 that are not necessarily on our website, because they're not contracted, or because the promoters are unsure about, as you mentioned, the COVID realities impacting upon whether or not the concerts can go ahead. But yeah, you know, I have a great deal of insecurity about concerts, generally speaking, at the moment in many parts of the world. So I think we just have to, be cautiously optimistic until we then are forced to face the contrary.
In terms of the dates that you did in the UK in the last couple of months or so, I mean, did you play the new music? Did that go down well?
Well, we've been playing the title track, The Zealot Gene, since pre-pandemic. We did a couple of shows in Spain just before the pandemic scuppered everything. That was in February of 2020, and we played it at all the shows we've done since the end of August. This year, we've managed to do, I think, 20 shows. We played the title track. Seems to go down well with the audience, and the reactions to the new album from media that I've spoken to, either they're being very polite and complimentary, or they genuinely mean it, but we'll find out soon enough whether people like it or not. And I'm never actually, I think since the early 70s, I've never been expecting approval. It's nice if you get it, but you have to realize once you're past your first three or four albums and you're the darlings of the new age of you've come to fruition in the public view, then no longer are you the bee's knees. You're no longer the latest thing, and you've got to accept that you're going to get your share of ho-hum or even very negative reviews. It's just the way things are. And so I'm never expecting people to like anything that I do, whether it's performing live on stage or releasing a new record. It's just, you know, if people are happy and they show their appreciation, then I am delighted if that's the end result. But I don't expect it. You know, it's not doesn't come with the territory just because you've sold a few million records, played a few thousand concerts. It doesn't mean that everything you do is going to satisfy everybody, because it certainly won't.
The inimitable Ian Anderson there, once referred to as the deranged flamingo due to his iconic posture, playing the flute while standing on one leg. It's such an iconic image, isn't it? It's instantly recognisable too, and one that's graced many logos and album covers. Right now, it's the time of Vintage Rock Pod, where I get to give you my top five songs from this week's guest. Now, remember, this is my personal choice. I don't claim it to be a definitive list. It's very subjective. And to be honest, I know that not many people are going to agree with me this week. But hey, it's my choice of songs, and everyone's is going to be different. So here we go, to cause a stir, my favourite five songs from Jethro Tull, according to Vintage Rock Pod. Now, my number five was originally a non-album single. It went top 10 in the UK in 1969. Its incessant riff rolls over and over, and I love its driving rhythm. At number five is Sweet Dream. At four is a song from the Benefit album in 1970. It's the opening track, in fact. It starts fairly low-key, especially vocally, but contains some great Martin Barr guitar licks, and I've always enjoyed the way the song kind of really builds to the ending, especially the dueling flute and guitar. Now, Ian Anderson had previously said that this album was more guitar-orientated given the era it was made in, with Cream, Hendrix and Zeppelin around, and it's probably up there with my favourite Tull albums, to be honest. And number four is With You There to Help Me.
I'm going back to the ones that I know. know I can be what I want to be. And just one week for the feeling to go, and with you there to help me, then it probably will.
And at number three is one from the Crest of a Nave album from 1987. Although the album has been dubbed their Dire Straits phase, given Ian's vocals on this, this may be one of the reasons why I like it so much. But anyway, this is a 10-minute epic, and for me, it stands up there with the very best the band has produced. It's got a great vocal hook, and I just love it. And number three is Budapest. Act 2 is a song with an opening like no other, menacing both in guitar riff and the opening lyrics. Although it wasn't a single, it still remains one of their very best known songs. It comes from the 1971 album of the same name, and number 2 is Aqualung.
Sitting on the park bench, five little girls with bad intent.
And at number 1 for me is another song from Aqualung, and it's probably a controversial, unexpected choice, but I love the heaviness of it. I love the raw, visceral vocals from Ian on this one as well, and the brilliant way it builds with the piano into chugging guitar riffs. So my favourite Jethro Tull song, and the number 1 song, according to Vintage Rockpot, is Hymn 43.
His cross was
So there you go, my favourite 5 songs from Jethro Tull. I can hear the outrage at the omission of Thick as a Brick, but given that the song is basically a whole album, much like Passion Play, I felt I wanted on this occasion to stick to singular tracks, so hey, please don't hate on me. Of course, there were so many others that I could have put in there and perhaps should have put in there. I mean, I missed out things like Locomotive Breath and My God. I mean, you could easily make a case for any of the first 10 songs on Aqualung to make that list, but there's other ones as well. Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die, Heavy Horses, Baker Street Muse, Living in the Past, Teacher. Honestly, so many great songs. Minstrel, Songs from the Wood. But I wanted it to be my personal choice, not a critic-style choice. It's the songs that I enjoy listening to the most. So there you go. As ever, though, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the list. Where do you agree or disagree? Drop me an email at vintagerockpod@gmail.com, and I'll give you a mention on next week's episode. And another request from me to say, if you haven't already, then please do subscribe to the Vintage Rock Pod channel on YouTube. I'm trying to push it to 1,000 subscribers, that it activates the kind of monetization policy that YouTube has. Until then, all the ads that play on my videos, YouTube keep the money from them, so it'd be nice if I got a little bit myself. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod, click subscribe on the channel. It's totally free, it's dead easy to do. You press one button, and I put up a lot of different content on there. You obviously get to see the videos of some of these interviews. There is one up there of Ian Anderson talking. I do short stories as well, some of the short rock stories on there. There's the top fives, there's a couple of quizzes from earlier in the series, and other bits and bobs too, so well worth subscribing to. Also, obviously check out the social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and all that sort of stuff as well. So there you go, that's it for episode 50 then. Next week's show is going to feature a brilliant interview with someone whose career is incredible, a star of TV, film, Broadway, and of course rock and roll, having had a successful solo career and worked with the likes of The Clash and Blue Oyster Cult and Meatloaf, so definitely do not miss that one. If this is your first listen, then make sure to follow or subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on whatever podcast platform you use, so you don't miss out new episodes that drop usually every Monday. And please do check out the back catalogue of incredible big name guests I've had on the show, whole host of superstars, multi-million sellers, Grammy Award winners, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. There's so much to enjoy, and they all have great rock stories involving some legends of our beloved rock world. And if prog rock's your sort of thing, there's plenty of prog rockers I've interviewed in the past, likes of Steve Hackett's on there, as I said, Thijs van Leer's on there, we've spoke to Jeff Downes from Yes and Asia and that sort of thing, so plenty for you to get your teeth into. But that's it for me then on this episode. Thank you for taking this Jethro Tull train with me. Check out the Zealot Gene and get ordering Laura's new book, Jethro Tull's Chronicles. Until episode 51 then. Remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.